This week on Vox Talks, could a $15 minimum wage cut deaths of despair? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Overall life expectancy in the US is falling, and an increasing number of studies have identified that this is being driven by midlife deaths among Americans who don't have a college degree. Deaths that Anne Case and Angus Deaton provocatively called deaths of despair. But if we can identify who is dying, can we also create policies that prevent many of these deaths? A new working paper examines whether raising the minimum wage may be one of these policies. One of the authors is Michael Reich, who is the former director of the Institute for Research on Labour and Employment at the University of California, Berkeley. And he is also the co-chair of the Centre on Wage and Employment Dynamics there. He joins me on the line today. Michael, welcome to Vox Talks.
Tim, thank you for having me.
The phrase deaths of despair has really shone a light on these problems. Can you remind us of the size of this problem and what we include when we talk of these deaths of despair?
Yes, the reversal in mortality rates is really astonishing. In the last 3 to 4 years, mortality rates among the population with less than high school, and especially among whites with less than high school, has been falling. It had been rising previously. It has continued to rise in all other countries. And Anne Case and Angus Deaton, as you say, spotlighted this problem. And their explanation that there are deaths of despair was, in fact, something that many people resonated with. They argue that people who are dying from despair are those who have been without jobs, who have had no wage increases, and who are increasingly isolated in their social lives. They don't go to church, they don't belong to unions, and they don't have other community connections. In our research, we are asking, can this problem be alleviated? But let me say what the problem of deaths of despair is. As Case and Deaton define it, there are three types of such deaths. There are drug overdoses, particularly from opioids, major epidemic of its own in the United States and some other European countries as well. They talk also about suicides, and they divide the suicides into the non-drug suicides and the drug suicides, because many people deliberately kill themselves using opioids or other drugs.
You have looked in your work, in this piece of work anyway, at the effect of state-level minimum wages. For people who don't know, live outside the United States, how much variation is there in the minimum wage in the U.S.?
In the last 35 years, the states have begun to increase the minimum wage, which they can do as long as it's above a floor that's created by the federal minimum wage. And right now, 29 out of our 50 states, plus the District of Columbia, have minimum wages higher than the federal level. The federal level is now $7.25.
Oh.
Seven states are on a path to a $15 state minimum wage, and quite a few cities, such as San Francisco, Seattle, New York City, have already reached $15. So the cities in quite a few states are going even higher than the states are. So there's quite a bit of variation, and also quite a few events over these years, which gives us a laboratory, so to speak, to study their effect.
You're using that variation, which, as you say, is considerable and tends to jump up stepwise, to estimate the causal effect of changes in the minimum wage on mortality, rather than on poverty, which is the normal way that we look at it. There's plenty of data on poverty, but is there enough detailed data about the causes of mortality that we can use for this?
You're absolutely right. There are already quite a few studies that show that increasing the minimum wage reduces poverty, even in areas where the minimum wage has a big impact, the lowest wage areas of the lowest wage states in the United States. When you look at the effects of minimum wages or other policies that increase income on health, you're looking at an area that's been examined quite a bit by social scientists. It seems intuitive that there is a causal relation. On the other hand, the causal relation can also work in the other direction. That is, if you have poor health, that might cause you to have lower income. And also, there could be other factors like an increase in unemployment in the economy as a whole that can affect both income and health. So our research was trying to actually identify the causal effect going from the minimum wage to a health outcome, in this case, so deaths of despair.
What is the headline result here?
The headline result is that increases in the minimum wage do reduce suicides, non-drug suicides, especially but not only among women, and they do so quite significantly and substantially. We find that a 10% increase in the minimum wage would reduce suicides by about 800 to 1,000 suicides per year.
Gosh.
What that means more concretely is that all the increases in the state minimum wages since 2009, when the federal government last raised the federal minimum wage, have saved perhaps 15,000 lives over that 10-year period.
As you said, raising the minimum wage seems to have a particularly beneficial effect for women. Why is this?
Because women have lower wages than men.
Uh-huh, yes.
So they are more exposed, you could say, or affected by the minimum wage. The increase in their wage is greater. It's an equalizing policy. 10% increase in the minimum wage for everyone implies a bigger increase for women than for men.
How confident are you that you managed to isolate a causal relationship here, something that's robust?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And a good deal of applied empirical economics in the past two decades has improved our methods to identify causality. And we use the state-of-the-art methods to do that. For example, we're looking only at those who have less than a high school education. And previous studies were not able to do that. We have restricted data from the Center for Disease Control, something called the Causes of Death Files. And we check our results by applying, in effect, a placebo treatment, which is, does increasing the minimum wage have an effect on suicides or other deaths of despair among college graduates? Where we would not expect to find an effect because very few college graduates get raises because of the minimum wage. And when we conduct that placebo test, we find no effect. So that reassures us that the methods we're using are not biased to find an effect where we shouldn't find one. We've also, since our working paper came out, done another placebo looking at the effects on cancer deaths, which are not going to be affected, at least in the very short run, in a year or two, by a minimum wage increase. And there, too, we don't find any effect. So that's reassuring. We also conduct some other very important tests for identifying causality. One can examine what we call pretrends. That is, we want to make sure that the group that is getting the minimum wage increase was moving in terms of, say, mortality, in this case, outcome, similarly before the treatment, before the minimum wage was increased, as to those who did not get the increase, a control group. And this is extremely important. We found in other minimum wage studies that have tried to just compare in a simple way the states that increased minimum wages with those that did not. We found that there are pretrends, that you don't have a proper treatment and control comparison. And that's because minimum wages do not get increased randomly. There's some reason why some states raise the minimum wage rather than others, and we want to take that out of the laboratory, so to speak. And then we also conduct other robustness tests to make sure that when we vary the sample period a bit, or we vary who we're including in the sample by age or so forth, that we get similar results. And this study does pass those tests.
However, you do note in the paper that raising the minimum wage didn't have an effect on the drug-related deaths that you talked about. Does that mean that these particular deaths of despair are beyond the reach of economic policy?
I think to some extent they are, and that's what our findings suggest. There is an opioid epidemic in the United States. Way too many prescriptions were easily provided to people beyond their immediate needs. And beside that, we've also had the return of a heroin epidemic. That is a big supply of cheap heroin has come into the United States. and another drug called fentanyl, which is many, many more times deadly and hazardous, in other words, than heroin or the opioids, has also flooded many parts of the United States. And so we think our results are consistent with the observation that these epidemics are responsible for the opioid deaths, the drug deaths.
As you very well know, there are still many, many politicians that argue firmly against a higher minimum wage or any minimum wage at all sometimes, because they argue it reduces employment. And recently, the Congressional Budget Office in the US reported on the effects of a federal minimum wage. They looked at a lot of the past research. They found it would cost 1.3 million jobs if it was raised to $15. Do you agree with that?
No, I do not. And I had been consulted, or I consulted with the Congressional Budget Office when they were preparing their report. I read the report very carefully. Most of my research prior to this study of suicides was on the employment effect. And I believe they seriously misread the literature on this. The best studies do not find that minimum wages reduce employment, or if they do, by very little amount. And that's consistent with all the studies that have been commissioned over a couple of decades now by the Low Pay Commission in the UK. The limits of those studies, though, is that they reach up to minimum wage policies that are about $10 an hour at the highest, because that's where the recent policies reach at the state and federal levels in the United States. And I've done a study that goes to the sub-state level and looks at the counties where the minimum wage has a really big impact, because the average wage or the median wage in those counties is even lower than the state level. And there, where we expect to find even bigger effects of the minimum wage than we would at $10, we estimate in our paper that these ratios of the minimum wage to the local wage, going wage, are comparable to what the states and the federal government would experience at $15 by 2025, which is what the House bill proposes. And we find that even in those low wage counties and metro areas, that the minimum wage does not have a negative employment effect. So I looked at the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, methods, and what they did was they put together a non-random group of studies. It was 11 studies, and they took the midpoint of those studies. But those studies included many that were outliers and which have been critiqued by others for their weak scientific methods.
And you're saying the granularity of the work that you can do now means that you can find effects that otherwise might be missed. You also criticized the methodology of those other studies when you were communicating with the Congressional Budget Office.
That's right.
What did they say to you?
They said, thank you very much. I think would be the answer. I would add also that I have done studies, as have quite a few other people, trying to understand why does the minimum wage not have a negative effect, even at $10 or $15. And some of these studies are at the same methodological level of rigor as the one we've been talking about. So we find, for example, that employee turnover goes down when the minimum wage goes up, and that saves employers on what we call non-wage labor costs, the cost of recruiting and retaining good workers. We also find the prices go up a little bit in the most affected sectors, which are restaurants and retail. And most other sectors, it's not important enough. There aren't enough minimum wage workers to make a difference. So it's actually quite understandable when you look at these other absorption channels, how the minimum wage increases are paid for.
Do you think some of the prejudice against raising the minimum wage comes from the fact that a lot of the people that are involved in looking at it have maybe taken one or two economics courses, and introductory economics textbooks all have a diagram about how when you put in a minimum wage, then it's guaranteed to cause unemployment? It's a simple diagram and it speaks to common sense. So it's quite hard for people to maybe revise their views after that.
Yes, the introductory economics course, Econ 101 version, basically is telling us what everybody already knows, that when we go to the supermarket and we see that the price of beef goes up and the chicken price does not, we'll buy more chicken and less beef. However, when we're looking at policies affecting the labor market, we have to look beyond the labor market itself to look at other adjustment mechanisms. In the advanced courses, we call this a general equilibrium rather than a partial equilibrium. That goes back to the British economist Alfred Marshall, who talked about how partial equilibrium was the analysis of one market at a time. General equilibrium, which is the modern economic analysis, asks how all the markets interact simultaneously. And so when you see that prices go up in some sectors, such as retail and restaurants, where the minimum wage has increased, but not a mile away where it hasn't, then you would say, oh, okay, in a multi-market context, firms ultimately would prefer to raise their prices a little bit than to lay off workers, because when they lay off workers, they're going to reduce their sales. Whereas when they raise their prices, they're not going to reduce their sales very much. So demand is inelastic for those goods. And when we leave that out of the discussion, we're missing quite a lot of the argument. Also, advocates of higher minimum wages often make a Keynesian argument that higher wages increase purchasing power of workers, and that increased spending that they will do, because they spend almost everything they get, will increase demand for output, which will increase demand for workers. And again, there are some excellent studies coming out of MIT and the Boston Fed that show this for the U.S., and there are some others for other countries as well. So this is also something that's left out when you're just looking at the microeconomics. You have to look at the macroeconomics as well.
Michael, these are issues that you've been involved with your entire career. Now there's a lot more attention given to inequality and poverty and policies that may lead to improving the welfare of a lot of the people that need it most. Are you encouraged by this recent attention? For example, there is a minimum wage bill under consideration now in the US, or have we just been here before?
Oh, we've been here many times before. Two things, I suppose, are different. One is that we have much more inequality in the United States, and I think as well in the UK, than any time since the 1920s. And it's been getting worse, especially at both ends, at the top end and at the bottom end. And we also have better data than we had 30 or 40 years ago, so we can analyze the results. And we have this improvement in the methods that economists use. And most important, there are movements to do something about inequality. And in the U.S., the Fight for 15, led by fast food workers and by some unions also, has been, you know, the most important reason it's been getting more attention.
And are economists more actively involved in creating research that translates into policy now?
Yes, there's a large body of literature that assesses policies using these rigorous causal methods and then are also involved in advising, say, the 2020 presidential candidates. Two of my colleagues are advising Elizabeth Warren, for example, on a wealth tax.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As you can imagine, there are a lot of sources for this if you want to do some more reading. If you want a short summary of what we talked about, specifically about the minimum wage and its effect on deaths of despair, there is a column on VoxEU that's called A Way Out from Rock Bottom, Economic Policies Can Reduce Deaths of Despair. And the authors are William Dow, Anna Godoy, Chris Lowenstein, and Michael Reich. And note that this also looks at the effect of another poverty reduction policy, which we didn't discuss today, which is the Earned Income Tax Credit. Now, if you want more in-depth analysis of the data and the methods and the rigor of the research, then look up the NBER working paper. That's 25787, same authors. That's called Can Economic Policies Reduce Deaths of Despair? If you're looking specifically at the minimum wage, then for that Congressional Budget Office report I referenced, go to cbo.gov and look for the effects of employment and family income of increasing the federal minimum wage. And if you want to read more of Michael's research that he's conducted with Anna Godoy into the impact of a minimum wage, then go to the Institute of Research on Labour and Employment's website. And there's a white paper on minimum wage effects in low-wage areas. So that's looking at that much more granular data. You can also read the testimony that Michael recently gave on the federal minimum wage bill. And there will be plenty more in the future, won't there, Michael? There is a lot of research on this now.
Yeah, the minimum wage is the most studied topic in labor economics. There have been hundreds and hundreds of papers, and what's remarkable is that the flood of papers keeps increasing in its rate, and I think there has been a new consensus as a result. More interesting is this move to look at other outcomes, like health outcomes, effects on child poverty, on child outcomes, on incarceration.
Fascinating. Michael, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Next week on Vox Talks, the major new study that for the first time allows us to calculate intergenerational mobility in Africa.
80 censuses conducted from 26 African countries. Some of those censuses were conducted in the 70s, some of them in the early 80s. So we can measure the education of Africans born even in the 20s, the 30s, and compare how their education compares to that of the next generation.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. Check out our episodes every Friday by subscribing on your podcast platform. Or find us at voxeu.org/vox-talks.